Okay, I'm going to talk about a wide hybrid, and it's an intersectional hybrid in vaccinium, the blueberries, between the cultivated highbush blueberry and a native blueberry that grows in North Florida and all the way up to Canada, called the deerberry, or Vaccinium staminium. There's two problems, there are two potential difficulties in making the cross. The first is that the ploidy difference, the highbush are tetraploid and staminium is diploid. And the triploid block in vaccinium is very strong. So I knew at the start of this attempt that I was going to have to get tetraploid vaccinium staminium plants. The other problem is that these are in different sections of the genus, so they are quite remote from each other genetically. And as I'll show later, there's a great many sections in vaccinium and a great many species in some of the sections. So the number of different possible crosses you could make intersectionally is enormous, and there's really no way to predict ahead of time which ones will work and which ones will not. So my goals were to produce enough F1 hybrids from a great enough diversity of parents of the two types to have a foundation for starting recurrent selection to develop a new type of berry that had features of both of these types. And the F1 hybrids, assuming that they were fertile, could be used to move traits in either direction. The highbush blueberry, of course, has been domesticated for 100 and something years now, but the deerberry, Vaccinium staminium, has some features that are not present in the highbush blueberry, some of which I'll show later on. The deerberries have never been domesticated, but they have a lot of potential for domestication. Jim Ballington, who grew up in South Carolina in a place in the Sandhills where there are a lot of wild deerberries, has been a long-term advocate of this should be a domesticated berry. And when I retired, I bought a place on a lake in Florida that was surrounded by sandy land that was full of deerberries, and I became immediately impressed with the quality of these fruits. Now this is a type of land, this is a deerberry plant about 4 or 5 meters tall in Florida. This is the bottom of the thing. And if you see those lichens growing on the soil, and you know the soils of the southeastern U.S., you will know that this is a very droughty soil. The plants you normally find growing with deerberries in Florida would be things like turkey oaks and serratifolia, which are both very droughty plants. So it's coarse white old remnant beach sand is where these plants are best adapted. In morphology, the deerberries are extremely diverse. There's only one species currently recognized in the deerberry, Vaccinium staminium, but it is so polymorphic from region to region, and even in one forest you find a great diversity of types. The ones that I used in my crosses had very much the architecture of a rabbit eye blueberry. If you're driving by in your car, you'd say, oh, there's a rabbit eye. You go out and look at it, it's a deerberry. So these get to be 4 or 5 meters tall, and usually their crown forming makes several sprouts from the bottom. So one of the interesting features of deerberries is that some of the clones make red flesh. The bottom row there is the highbush blueberry, and as you know, a freshly picked highbush blueberry, when you cut it open, is greenish white inside. All the pigments are in the skin. The deerberries are polymorphic for color. The ones that ripen up with a black fruit, when you cut them open, will be purple inside. But the bottom ones there you see are kind of yellow inside. So in one forest you find ones that are darkly purple inside and others that are yellowish white. There's the flesh removed from a highbush at the top and a deerberry at the bottom. This juice I made by picking about 100 milliliters of one of these black deerberries and mixing it with 4 volumes of water, and just squeezing the berries with my fingers underwater. And that's what the juice looked like, very much brighter and prettier than blueberry juice. And I put it on my desk, and 3 weeks later, it hadn't changed at all, except there was a scum of mold growing on the top of the thing. But it's a very stable anthocyanin, very, I think, much more stable than you normally would see in a blueberry. Actually, studies with the anthocyanin components have shown that the deerberry is very much more like a cranberry than it is like a blueberry. Deerberries flower on new flushes of growth in the springtime. If you look at the plants in midwinter, you would say these plants will not flower because there's no visible flower buds. Highbush, of course, has big fat flower buds that are made in the fall. The deerberries make copious pollen and flowers that are easy to pollinate. See that the corollas are very short. And I guess the reason it's called Vaccinium staminium is because when you look at the flowers, you see the stamens more conspicuously than anything else. But the stigmas and the styles are even longer than the anthers are. So there's some of the berries. The inflorescences are very open. Both the pedicels and the peduncles are very long. So it gives you a very open group of flowers. In my experience looking at blueberries wild in the woods, I have never seen any other vaccinium that has berries nearly as large as wild deerberries. These berries that I picked from one plant in the forest were about 1.5 to 2.0 grams per berry, which is equivalent basically to a cultivated highbush blueberry. And I could never find in all my looking in the woods a wild highbush that was more than 6/10 of a gram, or a rabbit eye that was larger than that. So I don't know all the vacciniums of the world if there's one somewhere that's bigger than that, but they are remarkably large for a wild blueberry. Other deerberry characteristics: they have exotic flavors. They tend, when you eat them, to taste sort of bitterish, and that would be one of the things that in domestication would have to be reduced. They're highly variable for that. Some plants make the berries that you hardly want to eat. Others of them taste rather like pears. The berries are juicy with small seeds. They have some of them have good post-harvest life. I picked some and put them in a paper bag on my desk for 3 weeks, and the only thing they did was shrivel a little bit, but they hadn't molded or broken skins or anything. One of the problems is that they're exceedingly difficult to clone. You can go out in the woods and like with an axe and a shovel and chop a bush into pieces and pot it up, and the pieces will live. But basically, you cannot root softwood cuttings, and you can't get them to sprout up from root cuttings. They graft fairly well onto high bush blueberry, and that's the way I'm getting my plants into the greenhouse to make crosses. One of the problems with many of the plants in the forest is that the berries fall off the bush when they're ripe. And I've noticed that they always grow where gopher turtles are found in Florida on this same type of sand. And I think the gopher tortoise is one of the animals that moves the berries around, in addition to deer and raccoons. But unlike the bird-dispersed berries, which hang on the bush, they tend to fall off when they get ripe. But again, this is polymorphic, and if you go into the forest when the berries are fully ripe, you would say, well, we don't have a very good crop this year on most of the bushes. But then you look under the bush, that's where the berries are. But then you'll see one bush out of 10 or so that seem to be loaded with ripe fruit, and they definitely are retaining the ripe berries much better. When the berry is picked or falls, the pedicel tends to come with the berry rather than stay on a bush, as it would with a high bush blueberry. The berries are high in Brix. The ones I've Brixed have usually been between 15 and 20, which is higher than most of the high bush. But as I mentioned, the berries tend to be bitter. Now, a little bit about Vaccinium and its sections, because I'm talking about intersectional crosses. 400 species of Vaccinium in the world, and 25 sections. Each section is like a one or more closely related species. There are 10 sections that are represented in North America naturally. And the blueberries we're familiar with in cultivation, high bush, low bush, Arabidae, Darawai, Eliadia, Atricocum, about everything that's ever been used to breed domesticated blueberries are in this section, Cyanococcus, which is native in eastern North America. Another section you may have heard of is the bilberries of Europe are important, gathered from the forest, section Myrtillus. Oxycoccus, cranberries are major crop, and these first three sections have 2X, 4X, and 6X species. And there's, as I mentioned, a really strong triploid block. So if you want to make 2X, 4X crosses, you need to get the ploidies adjusted. Sparkleberries are native in the southeastern U.S., and the polycodium, the deerberries, even though it's a highly diverse group, appear all to be diploid. That's Sam Vanderkloot's range map for Vaccinium stominium. There's a little bit in Mexico, both in northern and southern Mexico, and they're a little bit in Canada, but it ranges down almost all the way down the peninsula of Florida, out west to east Texas and up into Missouri. So it's extremely variable in plant architecture. Local populations are polymorphic for many characters, and it's considered one species. These are some previous intersectional crosses in Vaccinium. And I mentioned there's so many species, so many sections, that there's like an infinite number of things you could try. I would point out in the middle there are the Ballington crosses in 1980, in which he crossed the deerberries times four different section Cyanococcus diploids. And the crosses were not so hard to make, but the hybrids were highly sterile. Not 100% sterile, because they make unreduced gametes, which means you can cross them to tetraploids and get some three-way hybrids. The one on the bottom there is the lingonberry times the deerberry. And Dr. Meter, in his retirement years, made some of those crosses and got a lot of seedlings, but again, they were not very strong. So here's what I did. I created with colchicine 11 tetraploid stominium plants in the years 2011, 2012, 2013. And most of the F1s I'm going to talk about today came from the three plants I identified in 2011. And I identified the tetraploids because they made large pollen. The flowers were large, the pollen was large, and they worked in the 4X times 4X crosses. So from these crosses of the first year, I had 900 F1 seedlings. I call them putative, because I put them in the field to see if they were actually going to look like what they should. And they came from crosses involving seven different high bush parents and three different stominium tetraploids. And after a half a year in the field, I judged that 95% of them were hybrids. The 5% that were not hybrids were like three times bigger and looked a lot like highbush. So, and the two parent taxa are so different from each other that you can be pretty confident, just based on a six-month-old or one-year-old vegetative plant, that you got a hybrid. And of course, the hybridity became a lot more apparent when they flowered. So in December of last year, I dug 80 plants from my nursery when they were 1.1 year old from seed. None of them had any signs of any flower buds, so I was digging them on faith that maybe they would flower. I put them in a cooler for 5 weeks at 5C, put them in a warm greenhouse, and 52 of the 80 plants flowered, making 5 to 300 flowers per plant. And so then I checked to see how much pollen I could get out of the flowers. And I also looked at the pollen under the microscope to see if it looked like it was going to work. And 38 of the F1 plants made enough flowers, so I used them as females in crosses back to highbush or back to tetraploid stominium. Okay, so of the 46 F1 plants that I looked at the pollen, if you see it down at the bottom, only two of them had what I would call almost full male fertility. And five of them were essentially male sterile. They made a little bit of good pollen. The median plant had about 20% of the microspores good. When used as females, Well, the highbush female times F1 pollen, I pollinated 3,250 flowers. I got an average of 1.47 viable seed, what I thought was nice plump seeds per pollinated flower, which is not bad. The reciprocal cross, where the F1 was the female, gave me a lot more. And the F1 times F1 gave me 1.5. The third, this line here is another effort to make new Stibinium times high bush F1s. Oh, this line here. And again, I got like 0.6. The bottom line here shows a high bush times Eliotii. That's a 4x, 2x, but both in the section Cyanococcus, and it shows the strength of the triploid block. Those are very closely related, but you just don't get much. Phenotypes of the F1 hybrids, all the F1s were weaker than either parent. The F1s flowered on spring growth. The F1s all had antherons, which is a feature of Stibinium, but not highbush. The F1s had flowers open in the bud. I'll show you that in the pictures. That's the Stibinium character. In the F1s, the pedicel on some of them stayed on the berry and others on the plant. And some of the F1s, much to my pleasure, had purple internal flesh. The berry size was about like the Stibiniums. The berries of the F1s tended to fall off the bushes too easily, but not nearly as bad as Stibinium. And the bitterness in the F1s was far less than Stibinium. This shows the plants as they're just starting to flower, and they're flowering on new wood rather than old. This shows the flowers where the styles stick out of the flower before the corolla opens. And down at the bottom is that anthesis. You can see the styles come way out of the flower. At the top is highbush, and the bottom is an F1. This is an F1 flowering. You can see how long the styles are compared to the corollas. Another one, F1. One of the pleasant surprises was how fruitful these things were as females. About every flower I pollinated would make a berry, and almost every berry would have one or more seeds. You can see how open the clusters are, the long pedicels, long peduncles. Kind of a cranberry-looking berry, the shape on that one. They're quite different one from the other. Notice that the leaves are not very healthy, and that was partly because they had mites, and I didn't realize that. There's a certain mite that gets on azaleas that loved them. There's a berry, and there's a berry. Bottom line is F1s could be produced abundantly with no real problems. The F1s tended to be weak, but they could make a lot of flowers when they were only a year and a half old. F1s were quite variable. They averaged about 20% of the pollen good. They made a lot of pollen, but a lot of it was poor. And the F1s produced like 80% fruit set or more when pollinated with either pollen from highbush or from other tetraploid Stibiniums. The berries of some of the F1s had a green internal flesh, others red. F1s flowered on spring fleshes, and the berry flavor was quite variable for bitterness and sugar and acid. But I'm confident, based on what I've seen now, that that a person could move genes from Stibinium into highbush or from highbush into Stibinium. And what I'd really like to get in Stibinium is easier propagation, get them to root from cuttings, and get them to not fall off the bush when they get ripe, and get them to not be so bitter. So I'm quite happy with the way this turned out. Thank you.
Thank you.